Sometimes as we're exploring our experience, looking at our shortcomings, noticing these difficulties in our hearts and minds, it can be a little hard to see how love fits into this picture. We're so focused on suffering and looking at our suffering that we may not recognize how this quality of kindness, of friendliness, of caring is actually intimately connected to the whole path of practice. Our text that we've been exploring this week puts it very naturally into our path. Having abandoned the imperfections, the natural confidence arising, and with the reflection on that confidence, the kind of opening to, yes, I trust this path, the joy that arises naturally, and as Gil described yesterday, the kind of natural unfolding of delight and gladness and concentration, just naturally resulting. The text goes on to say, that one who has moved in this direction abides in metta, lives in metta. I'll read one of the phrases. He talks about the sutta expresses it not only with the quality of kindness, of friendliness, but also with the quality of compassion, the quality of sympathetic or empathetic joy, and the quality of equanimity. One abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. By one quarter here, it means a kind of a section of space, pie-shaped section of space. So one abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around and everywhere. One abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So this quality of abides, when we reflect on what it means to abide, it's not an effortful thing. And so the sense that I get from this is that there's a kind of a natural movement, a natural arising of these qualities, these relational qualities of love, of compassion, of joy, of equanimity. And so, how is it or why is it a natural result? My understanding of this is that as we practice, and as Gil said last night, you know, metta for him kind of came in the back door. He was doing his metta practice and, well, forget that, doing his mindfulness practice and forget that metta stuff. I was very similar. It's like I would go to retreats, long retreats, and just not go to that metta sitting. You know, it was just not for me. I would try it and I would end up torqued in knots. You know, it's like, obviously this isn't working, so forget it. So I just avoided it. But then over time I began to recognize it would sneak up on me. Every now and then I would have this open-hearted quality of love, or of, I remember one of the first times I felt this quality of sympathetic joy. It's like, wow, that's so different. I wasn't trying to do that. And so something about the path of practice carries these qualities in. And so the sutta describes, first of all, you know, if we go back to our sutta, we look at letting go of these reactive states, these reactive states in relationship. And as we abandon that, as we get to know, understand the reactive states of mind, and the mind naturally begins to abandon them, what it opens us up to is not non-relationship, but relationship in a new way. And so I'd like to start by just describing a little bit about these four qualities, and then explore how it is that they come along for the ride in our path of practice. So the first of these is usually metta. It's kind of the foundational state out of which the others, at least the three, the next two are defined. Metta, the Pali for metta, is related to the word for friend. The word mitta means friend, and the Pali for kindness is related to that word. So it could also just be considered friendliness, just a simple friendliness, a simple caring. Again, a very relational quality. So it's a sense of open-hearted connection with others and also with our own experience. This quality of kindness, of love, of friendliness, it may begin for us with just a simplicity of caring. And the full flowering of it moves to a kind of boundless experience, as described in this text, radiating the all-encompassing world, radiating, pervading space, abiding, pervading space with this quality, this heart of kindness. And so it can be experienced both as a very simple thing and also as a very profound, transformative state. The part of the transformative quality of it, or part of the profundity of that quality of metta, is that in this friendliness, in this caring, it is the active sense of well-wishing, but without needing anything back. So it has no demands for anything in return. So it's unconditional. That quality of open-hearted connection that doesn't require a response, that doesn't require any action from anybody. It's pure giving, the pure open connection. I talked about this a little the other night, those of you who were in the Q&A a couple nights ago, that possibility of connection without needing something back, and how healing that can be, how much that actual sense of metta is really often, I think, what we're looking for when we're trying to have somebody love us. I think our being is actually designed to feel the joy and the fullness of loving. And so this quality, this simplicity of this quality might be just, imagine meeting a dear friend you haven't seen in a long time. You know, somebody that you care about and that you haven't seen for a long time. How does that feel to just see them? You know, in that moment of seeing somebody you haven't seen for a long time, often all of the kind of history falls away, and there's just the purity of, wow, it's so good to see you, that sense of connection. That's that quality of metta. This open heart of metta. Metta itself is the connection, the open-heartedness. And that open-heartedness has kind of different flavors depending on what that open heart is meeting. So if the open heart is meeting struggle or suffering, if that open heart is in the space where someone is in pain, that open heart resonates with that pain, and the feeling is compassion, the second quality of the Brahma Viharas. So we could evoke this quality. If you think of maybe the easiest way to think of the purity of it without getting it confused with our own struggles. Think of perhaps a child who's suffering over something that you know isn't really harmful to them, but it's something new that they're learning, or something. When I was a kid, my mom came into my bedroom and found me sobbing one evening. I had just gotten to the part in Charlotte's Web where Charlotte dies, and I was sobbing. I was distressed, and my mom walked in, and I can just imagine, you know, just the compassion, the sense of, you know, the open heart of seeing the child in distress, not contracting around it. And my mom just simply said, you know, you have to keep reading. You know, so that seeing someone who's vulnerable in a place of distress is kind of the place where we begin to touch into that quality of compassion. In this place of compassion, we're not contracted. Compassion can meet suffering without being fearful or anxious about it. And this is part of our work. I think often in meeting suffering, especially in relationship, you know, this is where some of those reactive emotions come from. We see somebody in distress, and we want to fix them, and we want to, you know, we get self-righteous about somebody that's caused them harm, or so some of these reactive emotions come kind of rooted in this. A contracted response to seeing someone in distress. There's a movement of the heart that wishes to help, and yet there's also a little confusion. The feeling of compassion is the heart feels open and soft, but it's kind of quivering, or it's like almost jelly that's like shaking in response or in resonance to the suffering. So it has a feeling of, there's a kind of an openness with, there's not a feeling of pain or contraction, but there's also a feeling of wanting to act to alleviate the suffering. I think this quality of compassion, at least for me, one of some of the places that I've found it or have touched into it is in relationship to impermanence. Impermanence and suffering are so connected. You know, seeing how we're all subject to aging, subject to illness, subject to death. You know, the impermanent nature of being human can open us to a deep sense of the poignancy of life. One of the Tibetan masters, Sogyal Rinpoche, says, when we finally know that we are dying, you know, when we really know this, not just in our minds, but when we really know that we are dying, and all other sentient beings are dying with us, we start to have a burning, almost heartbreaking sense of the fragility and preciousness of each moment and each being. And from this can grow a deep, clear, limitless compassion for all beings. I kind of see we're all in the same boat. And it doesn't result in a sense of shutting down, but of, you know, the open heart meeting that truth resonates in response to that. On the other side, when that open heart meets joy, when that open heart meets someone who's having success in their life, someone who's happy, the response of that open heart is to resonate in sympathy with that happiness. It's really quite lovely. It's said that it's easier for us to feel compassion for strangers than it is for us to feel this sympathetic joy for our dear friends. I think partly because of our relationship with joy, and that we have a kind of a misunderstood notion that, I think basically we think there's only so much joy to go around, that if somebody else is feeling good, having some success, then it means there's less of that for me. And so envy, jealousy are quite familiar feelings that are related to, we could say they're the far enemy of this sympathetic joy. Because of this misunderstanding about joy. And in some ways, I think part of that misunderstanding comes from the usual way that we try to find happiness. We try to find happiness from getting more of what we want and getting rid of what we don't want. And a lot of times that may have to do with houses or jobs or money or relationships or, you know, so it's things in the world that we want. Or status, you know, we want to have the status of being someone who is in a particular position. And, you know, like maybe a quintessential example of this is like athletes going for the gold medal. You know, there's only one gold medal. And, you know, if happiness is tied to the things of the world and getting things, there is only so much in things to go around. And so that's, I think, where our confusion is. When we start to see the happiness of letting go, the happiness of release, the happiness of non-contraction, the happiness and delight of a mind that's not agitated, we see that this is limitless. There's no bounds to this kind of happiness. And then we can also see that we can be happy, be delighted in the joy of others. And every happy person is an opportunity for us to be happy, for us to resonate in that way. I think probably one of the easiest ways to get a taste for this quality of metta, where perhaps we don't have this sense of not enough for me, is in watching babies or toddlers learning how to navigate the world, you know, the joy that they experience in small accomplishments. One of my friends had a toddler, and she described to me something. She described to me that she was, that the toddler was walking in the playground, and she came upon a hump in the playground, and she'd try to go over the hump, and she'd fall down. And she'd get up, and she'd try it again, and she'd fall down. And she'd try it again. She just was so persistent. And then she finally did it, and she didn't fall down. She was just gleeful. And, you know, it's like just even hearing that made me happy, you know? So watching babies and watching their joy in accomplishment gives us a taste of that joy in joy, the joy in resonance. And it's not that we're like, you know, thinking, oh, that baby's happy, there's less of it for me, right? It's, we delight in their delight. We delight in their success. We delight in their accomplishment. The fourth of the Brahmaviharas is equanimity, upekkha. And this has got a different flavor than the other three. It's a balance of mind. Essentially, I think of this, that the quality of equanimity as being the ground in which the other three can fully flower. Because it's only with a balance of mind that a heart can take in all the joy and all the sorrow of the world and not be knocked around by it, not be thrown off by it. So upekkha, equanimity, is a kind of a balance, a non-reactive place of mind. But this non-reactivity is not indifferent. It's not a flatness. It's actually a balance of mind that allows the heart to open and feel more deeply. And so we may have this misunderstanding about what a non-reactive mind is. We're so used to living our lives through reactivity that we think that's like proves that we're human somehow. If we're angry or, you know, feeling distress, it's like, well, this is what proves I'm human. The balanced mind is not reactive to the joys and sorrows, but is open to them. And this equanimity also doesn't mean non-action. I think that's another way that we sometimes misunderstand what equanimity is. We hear these teachings in particular, you know, the teaching of mindfulness is really intimately tied to the practice of equanimity. When we're practicing mindfulness, we're cultivating that non-judgmental, non-reactive attention. And a lot of what we practice is observe, watch, not react, not take action on our reactivity. And so we may, in that practice, have the sense or get the idea that equanimity means just watching things come, watching things go, and not taking action in the face of what comes. Like, things as they are, that's okay. Things as they are, everything's okay. So that is a kind of misunderstanding, you know, that the heart of equanimity rather than acting out of greed or aversion or confusion, acts from wisdom, acts from kindness, from compassion, or from joy. So the motivation for action becomes really different, but there's still action. I mean, can you imagine? I was with my family at Thanksgiving one year, and my nephew was a toddler at the time. He was maybe two and a half. I think he had learned how to run. He had just learned how to run. He wasn't terribly controlled at his running, but he was practicing his running. And we were at a friend's house at this Thanksgiving, and he had discovered a circuit through the house where he didn't have to turn around, and so he just would run in circles. And he did this a lot, over and over. And we all sat down to dinner, and he continued to run. And I was sitting facing the room so I could see him making his circuits. And he was doing this and laughing gleefully and having a good time. And he came into the living room, and I was watching him, and he headed right towards the fireplace, which had a fire in it, at full tilt. And my whole being couldn't do anything except yell, which is what I did. I yelled at him, "Stop!" And the tone of my voice, I think, had a kind of power. It pulled him up short, and he stopped. So that was an example of, you know, action from compassion, from, you know, it's not, oh, things as they are. My nephew is going to run into the fireplace. Stop. And it welled up out of me. It wasn't even something I had to think about. It just came. So this is compassion at work. And the mind of equanimity has that kind of motivation. It's not a cold, indifferent kind of place. It actually meets the world with more feeling, I think, because the reactivity isn't there. The feeling of protecting ourselves and hiding from the world isn't there. So much of our reactivity is armoring ourselves and hiding ourselves from the world. With equanimity, we can be fully open and meet the world. So how are these qualities cultivated as we practice? How are they reflected on the path? I spent some time thinking about the Eightfold Path, which is the traditional form of the description of our path of practice. And I found it embedded, these qualities embedded all the way through the path. The first section of the Eightfold Path, wise understanding. And this is the orientation of, you know, the Buddha's exploration was around, is it possible to end suffering? And he found that it was. And the result there was a deep happiness, a deep peace. And so the whole of the Buddha's teaching is essentially towards happiness, letting go of the things that are in the way of happiness, this abandoning of things in the way of happiness. And he found that there are certain things, certain qualities, certain states of mind that that support us on this journey towards happiness. Skillful things, skillful actions that we can engage in, and actions that are get in the way. States of mind and ways of behaving that get in the way of that happiness. And so one of the key ways that wise view is defined is in understanding what helps us move towards happiness and what helps us let go of those things that lead us towards suffering. So understanding that basic distinction, what's skillful and what's unskillful with respect to letting go of suffering, letting go of dukkha, letting go of distress. And so the basic definition of what is unskillful are states rooted in greed, in aversion, and in delusion. And these 16 imperfections that are listed in this text all have at their root one of these three: greed, aversion, or delusion. When we see greed operating in the mind, we immediately feel an imbalance. We feel something's off, as I described the other night. As soon as wanting springs up in the mind, there's a feeling of lack. Something's wrong. I need to fill this. As soon as we don't want something, there's a feeling of things being wrong or off. I got to get rid of this. That's what will make me happy. And then delusion, this whole notion around conceit in particular. I'm better than, I'm less than, the same as. This comparison keeps our mind kind of in agitation, restless, trying to figure out where we fit in the world. And so these states keep our minds in a place of unease, of not being settled, not being balanced. The movement towards happiness is said to be based in states of mind, actions motivated by non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. And we can put that more positively: non-greed, generosity; non-aversion, kindness, friendliness, caring, metta; non-delusion, wisdom. And so right here, the motivation, cultivating, the Buddha encourages us to cultivate kindness, cultivate non-ill will, cultivate non-hatred. That opens the space to the heart of metta. So right from the beginning, this quality of metta is found in the path as a quality that's skillful, the Buddha suggests, is skillful to cultivate. And likewise with wise intention, the exploration of how do we act, given that we wish to move towards freedom. What's the natural intentions that arise from that? And that would be the intention to act from these skillful qualities and to let go of these unskillful qualities. And the classic framing of wise intention is to act from... Again, it's framed in the negative, mostly. Relinquishing sense pleasure, intention towards non-ill will, and non-cruelty. And those reflect on three of the Brahmaviharas. Relinquishing clinging to sense pleasure. Sense pleasure itself will come and go. Relinquishing sense pleasure doesn't mean actively pushing away pleasure when it arises, but relinquishing the desire to have to hold on to it, the desire to keep it and to push away unpleasant, hold on to pleasant. This is the intention towards equanimity, the balance of mind that can be at ease when pleasant arises and passes, that can be at ease when unpleasant arises, that can be open when unpleasant dissipates, can be balanced when experience is neutral, not needing to construct the world in a particular way. This is the quality of equanimity. Non-ill will and non-cruelty, intimately related to kindness and compassion. And these two, I think, are reflected in the next aspect of the Eightfold Path really strongly. The next section of the Eightfold Path is around ethical conduct, which is in the framing, again, in relationship. How do we relate to others? How do we relate to the world? And with an intention of non-harming. The precepts that we took at the beginning of the retreat are part of this aspect of the practice, the path. We are cultivating the intention towards non-harming. And in that, we are encouraging metta, compassion. Each one of those precepts is said to be connected to a beautiful quality. So the precept of refraining from killing living beings. In that act of refraining, we are cultivating compassion. In the refraining from taking what's not given, we're cultivating contentment, ease, connection with things as they are, with what is. So each of those precepts is reflecting a wholesome quality, a beautiful quality that's being nourished as we engage in the refraining from the action. And this is a helpful way to engage with the precepts, to not just think of it as kind of shutting off, I'm not supposed to do that. But as you engage in not taking that action, to connect with the possibility of how that non-action connects you to that other being. It's kind of a silly example, but it was very profound when I experienced this connection between not killing beings and compassion. I was doing a practice of killing the ants in my kitchen. And I was, I had an elaborate scheme. the ants would be, I didn't want the ants in my kitchen, so I kind of wanted to get them out, but I was practicing non-killing. And so I took a sponge that had soap on it, and I kind of created a big corral, because I discovered the ants wouldn't cross soap. So I created a corral so they wouldn't go any further. And then I worked the corral. I made the corral smaller and smaller and kind of worked their way back to where they were coming in. And, you know, this took a long time. This was not a quick thing, a quick fix. Some days I'd get impatient. And I would, like, one time I took a piece of paper like this, and I started scooping up the ants with a piece of paper that were in the corral, and I deposited them back by the hole where they were coming in. And I, did this for a while. And at some point while I was doing this, I noticed that there was an ant that was hanging out by the hole, by the place where they were coming in. And it was doing something really strange. I had never seen an ant do this. It got up on its back legs, and it was like scanning the environment. And I saw that, and my heart just broke. You know, it's like this. It was maybe anthropomorphizing, but it was kind of like alarm is what I saw. I saw a suffering in this being, and in kind of comparison, or by extension in the whole colony, alarm of what was going on. And my heart just broke with compassion. You know, I wasn't looking for the compassion. But the relationship with, I had a relationship with those ants. You know, practicing not killing them put me into relationship, and it changed my relationship. Very different kind of experience. So the practice of sila, the the practice of engaging in that, the action of non-harming or the refraining from can have a beautiful rebound effect on our hearts with the opening to these qualities. Wise effort, the basic definition of wise effort comes back to the wise understanding, where wise effort is around cultivating those qualities that take us towards happiness and abandoning those qualities that take us away from happiness. And so this is the action that we engage in through all of our path. And again, right embedded in that is the cultivation of these qualities of kindness, of compassion. Now we can cultivate them actively through, there are practices, meditation forms that consciously incline the mind, incline the heart towards these qualities. And that is a practice that we can do. And this is the practice that both Gil and I didn't like. we both fleed from the formal cultivating of metta through the saying of the phrases. So that is one way, and many people actually resonate with this quite strongly. And after a while, actually after I began to open to the quality of metta, after through the practice the metta began naturally arising, that's when I could engage in the conscious cultivation of metta. So there is the kind of formal practice that we engage in, and the Buddha talks about this. That the cultivation of metta, abiding, pervading space with this quality of friendliness. Metta is also cultivated as we practice mindfulness. And this is really, for me, where metta began to naturally arise, where the quality began to just kind of sneak up on me. It was like it was growing behind my back, kind of surprised me. So how does that work, or why does that work? I think it's because of the flavor that we're encouraged to hold our experience with, this non-reactive, non-judgmental, allowing, receptive attention is a form of kindness to ourselves and to our experience. There's a kind of an intimacy that this kind of attention gives. And I've been surprised at times at how much my experience was around the body. The body just loved this kind of attention. It got really happy. The body got really happy being paid attention to. It felt like it was just like every cell was pointing in the same direction. It's like, oh, yes. Just a deep sense of like every cell was being nourished with this attention, with this presence. We sometimes have a sense of what this quality of a presence can do in relationship. Just a simple presence, being with someone who is suffering, is very powerful. It's not trying to fix that person, not trying to change it, not trying to change the situation, but just witnessing, just being with, can have a very powerful impact. One day I was with a friend, and my friend started remembering a situation from his past that was a very distressing situation, and he was obviously upset. And I said, I'm willing to just sit here with you, And first he's like, okay. And he said, well, I don't know what to say. And I said, you don't have to say anything. I'm just willing to be here with you. And with that, it's kind of like something broke in him. And he just kind of let whatever was happening just come out. And he sobbed for a while. And I was just, what I was actively doing in that moment was just trying to be there without wanting to go away, without trying to fix, without trying to change. I was just trying to be present. That was what I was actively doing. And he came back to me a couple days ago and said, what were you doing? Were you doing metta? And I said, no, I was just trying to be present. And that was a real lesson for me in the connection between presence and metta. It was felt as metta. On my side, I was mostly aware of just the sense of being there, the willingness to be there. I wasn't so aware of a feeling of metta. And this is something I think that's important for us to know, that sometimes these qualities are coming along for the ride. And my friend felt the metta, right? My friend felt that that was what was going on. I wasn't particularly attuned to that. And I got some of this feedback from others, too. Oh, you're so compassionate. And it's like, huh, that's not my experience. You know, it's like... I feel present, I feel, you know, connected, but compassion, no, I don't know, I'm not feeling that. And I talked about this with a teacher, and my teacher said, turn towards the connection. You're focusing on emptiness, basically. You're focusing on just equanimity. You're focusing on non-reactivity. And so I tried that in the next interaction I had. It was just like a few minutes later. I tried, you know, oh, turn towards the connection. What does that mean? You know, I had not been very relational in my life. I'd been very much a loner. And so turning towards connection wasn't a natural thing for me to do. But I did it in the very next interaction. And whew, there was metta. There was compassion. It was there. I just hadn't known how to open to it. And so I think equanimity can be felt when we're just kind of in the flow of seeing change, being with experience, things as they are. But when we turn to that relation, we turn to relationship, that's where the qualities become apparent. And for me, it was like eye-opening. They had come along for the ride. I just hadn't really known where to find them or known how to open to them. Metta can also be revealed as we explore into our struggles. And so there is a way in which metta is cultivated as we meet our experience with this non-reactive attention. It comes along for the ride in that way. But also, you know, right in the midst of our struggles, sometimes the quality of metta is kind of hidden. A sense of wishing for happiness or safety for oneself or for others. So, you know, this is a very natural wish for us to be happy, to be safe. And that wish, in fact, that's how metta is expressed when we do it in the formal practice. We express the wish, may I be happy, may I be safe, may I be at ease, may I be peaceful, may I be healthy. It's a very natural wish, only so many times we have fear and pain around thinking, it's not possible. It's not possible for me to be happy, so I better not make that wish. I better not want to be happy. I better not want to be safe, because safety is impossible. And sometimes our reactive emotions are coming from a misjudgment, a misunderstanding around those core wishes for well-being. A wish for well-being is very natural. And so, you know, a couple of examples, or maybe just one example. I think I maybe just have time for one example of this. I was exploring depression on one long retreat. It was a kind of a low-grade, persistent depression. And I just watched it. I was observing it, feeling it come, feeling go. I was just doing exactly what we're instructing you to do here, watching this experience of depression. And, you know, using all kinds of tools if it got too much. But mostly, I could be with it. And at some point, I got to the place where I could just fully allow the depression and not fight it. I had realized that there was a kind of an imputation or a belief that somehow the depression was a problem, and that I was being mindful of it in order to get rid of it. And when I saw that, the mind just kind of went, oh, it's just like this. The depression is here. And there was a releasing from the feeling that it's a problem for depression to be here. It's just like, oh, here it is right now. And then a few seconds later, actually when I noticed that problemizing around depression, what I began to see is that the feeling of depression came and went really rapidly. So it would like be there for a few moments, and then it would disappear completely. It's like, wow, it's gone. Oh, there, it's back. And then, oh, it's depression, and I'm caught by it. And then, oh, it's gone. And then, oh, there it is. It's just depression. And so it's like almost, you know, dizzying how fast it would cycle through. So I was just, again, observing it. And at some point in meeting that feeling of depression, I began to feel it like felt like it just started to grow. It just started to get really big. And I was completely non-resistant to it at this point. So it's like, okay, depression, get big if you want to. You know, take the whole space. And it felt like it just got really expansive. And at some point in that spreading of the depression, the feeling, it was kind of a visceral sense that the contractions were kind of loosening and getting bigger. And at some point, the entire experience, like it felt like it turned inside out. And the experience was expansive metta. That was not what I thought I would see when I let depression get as big as it wanted to. But the very next thought gave me a clue as to what was going on. The very next thought in my mind was, this is stupid, this is sappy. This beautiful, expansive quality of metta, I had a relationship with that. This is a stupid, sappy quality of mind. And I could see that that depression kind of was related to holding at bay this beautiful quality of metta because of a view I had. Being metta, you're seen as, you know, being stupid, or, you know, just like Hallmark greeting card, sappy, you know. It's like, this was a belief. So right in the middle of that, the willingness to open to the depression and allow it fully allowed the underlying state or wish for well-being, wish for connection. Actually, it was a lot around connection, because it was a connectivity that I felt, a sense of loving beings. And so right in the middle of that depression, I found that place of connectivity. And then, of course, there was work to do because I had that, I discovered, or that, you know, this mindfulness brought that view about sappy and stupid into consciousness. I had no idea I had that relationship to metta. It made it possible to work with it. So the depression at that point basically left. I've had multiple experiences where some struggle, it feels like, sometimes it feels like whatever struggle there is, it's like the whole thing, we think the whole thing is bad. You know, this state of fear, you know, it's like, just take a scalpel to it and cut the whole thing out. It needs to be excised. But often I think in the middle of these states, there is some seed of something beautiful, like the wish for safety in the midst of fear. And sometimes we can, through the practice of mindfulness, of meeting, of being with this knowing that we're talking about here, it can reveal this beautiful core. And we start to see how that our relationship, it's our relationship to that. You know, the wish for safety, the fear is often about, how can I make sure I'm safe? How can I can't make sure I'm safe. And that's a problem. So sometimes we can touch back into the purity of that wish. And begin to experience a new relationship. So the sutta speaks from the perspective of relationship very much, as Gil pointed out. I think it seems particularly suited to us as lay practitioners because it is talking about these relational emotions. It starts from our usual relationship of relational emotions being the reactive emotions. How can I get? How can I be better? How can I prove I'm right? How can I not have what I want? Our kind of short-sighted perspective on the world. It starts from there, and then it encourages us to a shift, to have a relationship with the Dharma, a relationship with knowing, a relationship with this bath, this river of mindfulness. And this allows the natural unfolding, as Gil talked about, the natural unfolding towards the confidence and the joy that comes from that confidence and the unfolding of concentration. And in that place of concentration, we naturally see sometimes the place of concentration is called the bliss of seclusion. We are for maybe temporarily at times secluded from all of this reactive stuff, and we begin to get a taste of this open heart. So metta also, compassion, joy, and equanimity are a natural unfolding from the path. And yet these states too, all of these beautiful states of the concentration, the joy, the gladness, the delight, the confidence, the kindness, the compassion, the equanimity, they're not the goal. And the Buddha said that he found the path because he was not satisfied with wholesome states. He was not satisfied to be just content resting in that, because he saw they come and they go. And so the path doesn't end here. There's more to turn towards, more to explore. And yet we're exploring it from a really beautiful place. So let's sit for a minute.